the path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio, a show that explores the power of active nonviolence across the world and in ourselves. Today is Friday, September 4th, 2015, and we're broadcasting from our mother station here in Point Reyes Station. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook of the Meta Center for Nonviolence, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Michael Negler, who is the president of the Meta Center for Nonviolence, and one of our wonderful interns at the Meta Center is here to join us, Ilian. But today we're going to be talking, besides after we get to the nonviolence in the news, it's going to be at the end of the show today, the news that isn't often reported in the mass media. We're going to get to look at that. But, you know, September started and it's time to look at education formally. What does the education system need in order to help people to thrive and to live at their best? And we're honored to have with us today Zoe Weil, who is the co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education. And we'll talk about what that means, humane education. And she's considered a pioneer in the comprehensive humane education movement. Zoe created the Institute's Masters of Education, Masters of Arts, and graduate certificate programs, as well as their acclaimed humane education and most good workshops, which is an idea that I like a lot because it's very Gandhian in the idea of Sarvodaya, of the uplift of all, and how to really incorporate that into our consciousness and our thinking on a regular basis. Zoe is the author of 6 books, and I have one here in the studio with me because this is how I was introduced to her work, which is called Above All, Be Kind, Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times. I got this book as a Montessori educator, and I am very interested in going through some of that material, hopefully, in this longer conversation with her today. But she's written some books for children as well, or young readers, including Claude and Medea, and which received a Moonbeam Gold Medal Award. And she's written numerous articles on humane education and humane living, and she's given interviews to such outlets as Forbes.com and on numerous radio and television stations, including local radio like ours. And what's interesting is in 2012, artist Robert Shetterly painted Zoe's portrait for his acclaimed Americans Who Tell the Truth series. So we're going to have a woman with us telling the truth. And she was honored with the Women in Environmental Leadership Award at Unity College. And in 2010, she was inducted into the Animal Rights Hall of Fame. She received her master's degrees in theological studies from Harvard Divinity School in 1988 and English literature from UPenn in 1983. She is also certified in psychosynthesis counseling. She lives with her husband and several rescued animals in a home adjoining the Institute for Humane Education in Surrey, Maine. So thank you so much for joining us here on the radio show on Peace Paradigm Radio, Zoe.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Stephanie. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's jump into this because we have a short amount of time and there's so much that we can cover in this idea of humane education. So to bring us into the conversation, I wanted to talk about the notion of humane education and the way that we have contextualized this in our work in nonviolence at the Meta Center for Nonviolence Education. Is that when we look at Gandhi's freedom struggle, the work that he did in India, He'd had this charkha, the spinning wheel, and everybody had to engage in the spinning wheel at least 30 minutes a day. And this was what's called constructive program in the nonviolence movement in India. And we often look at, well, what would be that kind of constructive program today? Because that was, you know, helping them to have economic independence and to uplift the poor and to throw colonialism off of them. And as we look at today at the Metta Center, we've had this conversation a lot, and we think about the human image as being the charkha of today, because it's we have in the mass media such a low image of what it means to be a human being. And there's a lot of actions then that come from that low image because, you know, this is what we've learned in our schools and this is what we're told that we are. So why try any harder? And you're really coming at that from a different angle in humane education. So I was wondering if you could talk about some of those qualities that you think are part of humane education that help to raise that image of the human being.
Sure. Well, the word humane literally means having what are considered the best qualities of human beings. So if you imagine that humane education is a process of learning how to deeply embody the best qualities of human beings, and all that entails, you can easily imagine how that would lead to this uplift that you're talking about. And as a humane educator, somebody who teaches about the interconnected issues of human rights and environmental preservation and animal protection, I often will begin presentations and work with young people asking them what they think are the best qualities of human beings, because I don't need to impose any list of my own. We all tend to agree on those best qualities. And I say that with some certainty because I've asked thousands and thousands of people that question, what do you think are the best qualities of human beings? And nobody says greed, and nobody says hatred, and nobody says violence, and nobody says anger. Mm. People talk about compassion and kindness and generosity and perseverance and courage and honesty and integrity. But how do you actually put those qualities into practice in a complex globalized world in which our choices, our everyday choices from what we eat and what we wear and what we buy, everything that we do, can have an impact on people around the globe whom we will never see, on animals around the globe whom we will never know, and on the environment that sustains us all. So when perceived that way, you can see that humane education isn't soft work at all. Mm-hmm. It is probably the deepest, hardest work that requires the deepest, hardest level of critical and creative and systems thinking, and yet is ultimately the greatest reward for humanity if we can raise young people who want to learn about the impacts of their lives in the world, who want to create real solutions to systemic problems, and who want to embody these best qualities that they themselves articulate. When you do that, the recipe is for a deeply meaningful, deeply joyful life, as well as a repaired and better world.
So just that, that's it. It seems like a huge undertaking, though, and I was wondering if you would talk a little bit more about if these are the best qualities and we all agree upon them, then why is something like humane education so new?
Well, it isn't new, actually. Hmm. Humane education as a concept has been around for over a century, and the early humane educators were people who started the very first humane societies for animals, as well as the very first child protective societies for children. So that is the legacy of humane education. And then for many years, humane education sort of drifted into being the purview of just humane societies and just education about how we should treat companion animals, dogs and cats primarily. And in the 1980s, a number of us worked really hard to expand that meaning to its original meaning. And so it's really not a new concept. Mm. It is, however, still not integrated into schools. Now, about 18 states have laws that require humane education, but it's ill-defined, and it usually is about education related to dogs and cats. It's just not as deep as what I just described to you. And unfortunately, in today's educational climate, you know, we have recess and the arts and being slashed from school budgets, so there's less and less time for anything outside of, you know, math and language arts and science and history. And that's a shame, because humane education doesn't need to be its own subject. It simply needs to infuse all of education. And if we perceive it that way, and we begin to infuse all of the subjects with this lens of looking at how the basics, the foundational subjects that we learn in school, relate to how we lead lives of integrity and purpose and meaning and goodness and solve the problems we face, if we perceive it that way, then we make the whole educational endeavor so rich and so important.
Well, Zoe, as I'm sure you're aware, the word education itself means to lead out, to draw out of a person what's already in them. And this goes back to Plato. I was wondering if you find it more effective to work outside the educational system, creating your own schools, your own programs, or do you find it working to try to infuse humane ideals in the educational system, of which I am a refugee, by the way, not a migrant, by the way, a refugee, and or are you doing a combination of both? Which strategies have you found most effective?
You know, I think that we need to do all these different strategies, and there are days where I'm very disheartened by the direction of our educational system, by our schooling system, and then, you know, I get so frustrated, and I think, you know, why do we even bother? But I would never give up on it. The educational system is the root system underlying every other system. There is no other system I can think of that doesn't have its roots in education. And so we must address it, and we must change it. At the same time, you're right, there's the seeds are more easily planted, and they sprout more readily outside of the traditional education system. So the way we have been approaching this is we train anybody and everybody who wants to be a humane educator. We have online graduate programs through Valparaiso University, and we have students in that program from all over the U.S. and Canada and around the world as well. And some of them are public school teachers, some of them are private school teachers, some of them work at nonprofits, some of them start businesses, some of them are artists. Some of them work in religious education, very, very wide range of people. And we would love to have about half the people in that program be classroom teachers in the traditional public school system, because we do want to have a big impact there. We also lead workshops, and we have online courses, just short online courses, so not part of a grad program. We have people all over the world who do that. And again, they bring it into their communities in many, many ways. So homeschooling parents and concerned citizens might take our Teaching for a Positive Future course, and they will incorporate what they learn into various settings, including, you know, summer camps or after-school programs or the arts. So I would say we have to cast that net really wide. And as far as we're concerned, anybody who can have a group, a community, an outlet for bringing these ideas should, and we want to help them to do that.
Well, that's really wonderful. It sounds remarkably similar to what the approach of the Meta Center, actually, because we have three target audiences that we talk about: media, educators, and activists. But in reality is we work with anyone who wants to learn more about nonviolence and find out how to practice it more safely and more effectively. And so I want to ask you this, Zoe. Stephanie and I recently went to a meeting in Santa Rosa of the Restorative Justice organization there that's bringing restorative justice into the schools. It was extremely encouraging, and it was one of the biggest public gatherings that we've ever been at on a subject related to our own. Do you, in humane education, do you look at restorative justice specifically?
You know, there's not much that we don't look at. So absolutely. In fact, I have a new book coming out, The World Becomes What We Teach, Educating a Generation of Solutionaries. And I open the book with stories about young people at various levels of schooling. And I tell these stories about them learning about an issue and then, you know, becoming thoughtful solutionaries to try to address that issue. And one of the stories is And these are not these are not real stories. They're stories that I made up to illustrate what humane education can be. And one of those stories is about a young man who's just alarmed by our prison system and our incarceration rates. And so he pursues learning about restorative justice and getting a certificate in restorative justice in high school so that he can practice it. So that was one of my examples of what humane education can do.
So I'm doing a series of daily a daily column on Gandhi's thought for 2015-2016. And this month I'm focusing on education and Naitalim, which is the system of education that he was working with in the Indian freedom struggle. And one thing that I've noticed in his writings and his speeches about education in particular is that he was actually, you can see his anger in that. And people don't necessarily think of Gandhi as an angry person. But what we know is that he transformed his anger. He channeled it into, you know, something greater. So he was angry and he used it and he put it at this problem that he saw happening. And that's a good use, a very productive use of something that can be very, very destructive. And I'm curious about you as a person. What brought you to humane education? And what do you do when you get angry about the state of the world?
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think that anger has been a huge fuel for me. I mean, if we're not angry about injustice and about cruelty and about environmental destruction, you know, something's missing in our soul to me to not be angry about it, or sad, one or the other, right? Some people respond to injustices and cruelty with sadness and some with anger and some with a combination of both. I'm one of those people who responds to it with a combination of both. And so, you know, as a humane educator, I'm also exposing people to injustice and cruelty. I mean, there's no way to solve these problems if we don't know about them. So I'm quite aware that my work and the work of humane education is going to likely spark anger and sorrow. And there's a wonderful book actually called Healing Through the Dark Emotions by Miriam Greenspan, and it is in the suggested reading list for our graduate program for all of our courses because it's very helpful when people face that. And as Joan Baez said, action is the antidote to despair, and I also think it's the antidote to rage that is dysfunctional. And so to answer your question, how did I get into this work? I was angry and I was heartbroken as I learned about what was happening in our world, and I wanted to do something. And the traditional forms of activism that I discovered, you know, when you reach out to an organization and you say, I want to help in some way, you know, for me, this was back in the 1980s, you know, I would get lists of action steps and calls to leaflet or protest. And so I was writing letters to companies and to my senators and representatives, and I started to do leafleting. And while all of those things are important, I did not find them as satisfying as I needed to sort of persevere with them. And in 1987, I heard about a summer program at the University of Pennsylvania. I was in graduate school at the time, and it was offering week-long courses to middle school students, and I thought, well, I could teach some courses. So I pitched 5 courses to the director. She said yes to all of them, and 2 of them were humane education courses. One was on animal issues, and one was on environmental issues. Actually, 3 were humane education because one was also on media literacy and watching television critically, except there weren't enough kids who signed up for it, so it didn't run. But the other courses did run, and it was amazing to me to watch the transformation in my students when they learned about what was happening in the world. And in one case, one boy became an activist literally overnight. So on Wednesday, this was in the animal issues course, I talked about product testing on animals in which, you know, everything from soap and mascara and oven cleaner dripped into the eyes of conscious rabbits and force-fed to them in quantities that kill and smeared on their abraded skin. And he went home that night and he made his own homemade leaflets. Now, this was in 1987, so he did not have a personal computer. So that meant he hand wrote his leaflets. And he came back into class the next morning with a stack of them and he wanted to hand them out. But not to his classmates. He wanted to hand them out on the street. So while the rest of us were having lunch, he was standing on a Philadelphia street corner handing out his homemade leaflets. And many of the kids in that class became activists just from a week-long course. So that is when I realized I could make this my life's work. This could really transform our world because I watched kids be transformed in such a short period of time. I'm still in touch with some of the young, well, they're not young now, they just turned 40, some of the people who were in that first class. And one of them, I hadn't seen him in 18 years, and I was giving a talk with Jane Goodall in New York. This was a few years ago, and I invited him to come because he'd been working for the mayor in New York on HIV/AIDS work, so he was still an activist. And when I introduced him to friends and I said, this is David, he was in the first humane education course that I taught. And before he could even finish my sentence, he interjected, that course changed my life. So if a week-long course can change a child's life, imagine what would happen if this kind of education infused our entire educational system.
Yes.
We would solve our problems. I just have no doubt about it.
So I think I read in your book that, or in an article that you wrote, that it was somewhat disheartening and at the same time, you know, made you feel good as well that a student told you that it was the best week that they spent in their life so far.
I know.
And yet, why should just 1 week with you be the best week they've ever had? School can be that way.
Exactly. And, you know, so I often get thank you letters when I do, you know, courses or presentations in schools. And that particular letter was particularly wonderful to read. You know, she said, spending that week with you is the most inspiring week of my life so far. And this girl was 14. And, you know, I felt so good about myself. Like, oh, I, you know, knocked it out of the park this time. You know, I just felt great. And then I thought about it, you know, and I just kept thinking about it. And I thought, that is so depressing. You know, spending a week with me was the most inspiring week of a 14-year-old's life. That's just awful. That's awful.
But I've also heard, though, as well, that we need mentors in our lives, and not everybody can be that mentor. And it just shows, really, the power of the human being that in the midst of so many different influences, one person who's holding on to the good, to the humane, can have a very, very deep impact, much deeper than more superficial interactions that they might have. And that, to me, is really heartening.
Exactly. And that should be what every teacher is to every student.
Mm.
I mean, every child who goes to school has dozens and dozens of teachers over the course of their education. Imagine if we're all humans. Not everybody's going to connect with everybody. But shouldn't every child every single year have somebody in their school who is that mentor, who is that inspiring figure to them, who really helps them to think deeply and to want to be the best human being that they can be? I mean, if that isn't the purpose of schooling, what is? And sadly, the current mission of the United States Department of Education is to prepare students for global competitiveness. Now, that's not a joke statement. I mean, we hear it as a, you know, one of those sound bites. And I, you know, I've heard it for years and I thought, okay, yeah, you know, it's what politicians say or it's what business people say who, you know, feel like we're not competitive enough. But it's not really what the mission statement is. And it really is. All you have to do is go to the mission statement of the United States Department of Education. And it's right there.
The shocking thing to me, though, was that the radical students have bought into this almost as much as anybody else did, having come through the free speech movement, where I thought we were shaking down the institution and were going to make it into what you now know as humane education. But it was one of these decisions that was made without any discussion and was made across the political spectrum. And I watched it happen for 40 years at the University of California. And I was terribly disheartened until I found out that I don't need them any more than they wanted me. Mm. Now, I think the problem with the educational, well, the problem, one of them is that the best teachers, like yourself, get discouraged and can't function within the system. And that's why you need to build an outrigger first in the hopes that you can prove something that the system will then pick up.
I know. It is very, very frightening that, you know, many teachers are leaving. Many of the best teachers are leaving the profession because it's just about, you know, educating students now to pass these bubble tests, these standardized bubble tests. And, you know, it's not as if I'm trying to suggest that students shouldn't be prepared to, you know, enter the workforce and do well in it and, you know, quote unquote, compete in the global economy. It's just that's not a high enough purpose. It's a very, very narrow vision of what education can and should be. And the irony is that there are other countries like Finland, which have an entirely different approach to education, where the teachers in Finland are in the top 10% of their graduating classes in high school. It's very prestigious to be a teacher, and it's very difficult to be a teacher. I mean, it's akin to being a doctor in our culture. And it's not that their pay is any different from the pay of teachers in the United States, although they get paid a similar salary for many fewer hours of work, many fewer school days and fewer hours, but they have autonomy. And they don't teach the standardized tests, and they aren't they're not graded against each other. They're not competing against each other. They get to be collegial. They get to collaborate. But the assessments that they give their students are the ones they design themselves. And on the international tests that are conducted on education, the Finnish students are so far beyond students in the U.S. And those tests are not the standardized bubble tests. So those PISA tests, the international tests, are they measure critical thinking and creative thinking and real problem solving. And, you know, America is so far behind. So if we really did, if our goal really was competing in the global economy and doing well on the PISA tests, we would be educating in an entirely different way.
I'm really glad to hear you say that. For one reason, my book is now being translated into Finnish.
But, wonderful.
But, you know, in Gandhi's educational system, there was a very prominent educator. Her name was Asha Devi Aranyanayakam. Mm-hmm. And she was interviewed once in a film that the BBC made. It was called Gandhi's India. It was a very, very prestigious and well-made film about Gandhi. And the interviewer asked her, well, don't you think that Gandhi was unrealistic, that he didn't acknowledge the limitations of human nature? And you just see her on the screen, she just kind of turns into a butterfly. Just suddenly she's radiant and her fingers are flying in every direction. And she says, there are no limits to human nature.
You know, one of my favorite quotes of Gandhi's and one that I write about and I strive to teach and live by is when he, on one of his days of silence, he was asked by a reporter, what is your message? And of course, we know Gandhi had quite a big message and he was not averse to sharing it. He shared it all the time. But on that particular day of silence, he responded by jotting down on a piece of paper, my life is my message. And, you know, I tell students and I tell people of all ages because I, you know, do adult workshops as well. But I realized from the moment I read that quote that if Gandhi's life was his message, then my life is my message. That, in fact, all of our lives are our message, whether we like it or not. So the question really is, are you living your life in such a way that you are modeling the message you most want to model? And that can be all of our mantras, right? You know, my life is my message is for me a mantra, and I strive to make choices that do the most good and the least harm because I want to model a message I'm proud of.
You're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. We're talking with Zoe Weil, co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education. And as we were talking about this idea of my life is my message, which was Gandhi wrote this to a reporter one day who said, Gandhi, I need a message. What is it? And Gandhi wrote it down and said, my life is my message, meaning look at every part of the way that I interact, what I do, how I act. This is the message that I have to show, that it's not divorced from my intellect, is not divorced from my actions. And this in itself, we want to talk about how this integrates into education in particular. And so your book, Above All, Be Kind, Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times, I got interested in this book. It was handed to me by my colleague at a Montessori school where it's an early childhood program that I'm a part of, 3 to 6 years old. And one thing I really, really got out of it that I really appreciated was that you give very specific details and exercises and ideas to parents who could integrate humane values into their relationship with their child. And so I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about the adult-child relationship, because we were talking earlier about having mentors in the world. And when we reimagine a humane world, we all of a sudden see children as mentors in as much as, you know, the adult mentor. The other day, a two-year-old came into the class, little brother of one of the little girls, and he's been coming in regularly as he gets bigger and he can walk now and he has some words. And it just was so pure and so sweet to hear him say good morning to me that it just lit up my heart when after mm-hmm. later that day I went home and saw the picture of Syrian children mm-hmm. Coming onto shore, having been in boats that have capsized. And there's this great divide in our world in this way where these horrors are taking place. And yet in this innocent child, we can understand why we're doing the work that we're doing. So your relationship as well with your son, Forrest, that you speak of in this book, sounded also like you're really putting a lot of mindfulness into cultivating that relationship. So I was wondering if you just talk a little bit about children and how they fit into the picture.
So I wrote that book because I've been a humane educator all of these years, and I wanted to give parents the tools that I had discovered as a humane educator so that they could raise their children with these tools. And so it was really my way of saying, you are your child's first humane educator and most important humane educator, so here's what I've learned. And it's funny, you know, thinking about that book now, my son is 22 years old now, and he's a really wonderful young man. And I often wondered, you know, during the teenage years, were the seeds that I planted really taking root? And would he care as much as I cared about the issues I cared about? And, you know, I watched him this past summer working for an organization called Environment Virginia, and he raised $15,000 for them through his canvassing work, and the Clean Water Act was just renewed just recently, and you know, he worked so hard on that, and I was so proud of him, and I thought, you know, these seeds do need to get planted very young in children. Now, that's not to say that if they're not planted very young, it's too late. That I don't believe that at all. I believe that at any point in life, somebody can, their heart and mind can be awakened simultaneously to the issues in the world that concern them, and they can harness their passions and their talents and their skills and become solutionaries in whatever way they are motivated to. But it certainly is helpful if at a very young age we really cultivate a sense of wonder and awe and reverence for the natural world, for other people, for other species in very young children, and so that as they get older and they're ready to learn about, you know, the real challenges we face and about other children who are washing up on the shore, who are refugees and who haven't made it, so that they can learn about that and do something about it when the age is right, when the time is right for them to know that. And that then they're willing and able to shoulder the responsibilities of being a problem solver and a change maker and an activist. And so it's critical that parents have those tools particularly because it's not always happening in our school system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I see, so there's a few activities that I thought were very, very interesting, and I myself would like to explore more of the work of the Institute for Humane Education and to see how I can integrate more of that into my work in the classroom. But you talk about, I think they were Wonder Walk. Yeah, the Wonder Walk. And that one, it seems like it could be something very, very special for parents to do with their children. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So there are sort of two quintessential humane education activities. Of all of the hundreds and hundreds of activities, the Wonder Walk is my favorite reverence-building activity, and then True Price is my favorite activity for really becoming a systems thinker and a critical thinker. So in the Wonder Walk, you pair up, and it could be a parent and child. It could be two children together. It could be a child with his or her grandparent or teacher and student, doesn't matter. But you pair up, and one person closes their eyes, and the other person takes them on a walk. And it can be in any natural setting, and it can be a small, tiny little piece of nature. You know, you could be in an inner city, but you found a tiny little piece of nature. Of course, it's lovely to do it in a really, you know, beautiful wilderness or nature center. But you have the person close their eyes, and the guide will introduce them through their senses to various things in nature. So they'll walk them very carefully and slowly, holding onto their arm and their hand so that they're safe, to something to see or hear or smell or touch or taste. And to see something, they will tap next to the person's eye, which means open your eyes. And, you know, they might have adjusted their head a little bit, tilted it up or tilted it down, or helped them to, you know, get down on the ground to be near a flower or the bark of a tree. And so they let them see for, you know, 20, 30 seconds, and then they indicate to close their eyes again by tapping again. They might touch their earlobe, which is the indication to listen. They might tap the tip of their nose, which is the indication to smell. They might put their hands right on something, whether it's bark or it's a flower petal or it's the grass or something right in their hands to touch. And then if they really know that something is safe to eat, like a wild strawberry or some mint or something that they are absolutely recognizable as safe, then they could tap next to their lips and the person parts their lips and they pop a, you know, raspberry or strawberry into their mouth. And it's so profound. And it may sound like nothing, you know, on the radio as people are listening, but just try it. I mean, I remember doing this with my son when he was 6 years old, and he led me on a Wonder Walk, and he helped me to lie down on some mossy ground in Maine where we live, and he positioned me so that the sun, we were in deep woods, they were very, you know, dark woods, just like you have in Marin County. But there was a ray of sunlight that was coming through the trees, and it hit my face so I could feel that. And when he tapped my eyes, it was his face in front of me. It was probably, you know, one of the most memorable, sweetest, most beautiful moments with my son. And then he did it with his friends. His best friend when he was 9 was a 10-year-old boy, and they would do Wonder Walks together. I mean, it was just amazing. And, you know, this is a kid who grew up to play every team sport and, you know, he wasn't a typically sort of touchy-feely boy, but it was beautiful to watch him do that. So that's my recommendation for the Wonder Walk. And if anybody wants to see any of these activities, they're on our website in our resource center. We have an award-winning resource center, and our website is humaneeducation.org. So people can go and find them. And I don't know if I have time to describe True Price, but look it up. It's the quintessential critical thinking.
We'd love to have you talk about it if you have time.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So True Price looks at an everyday item. So anybody can pick any item in their pantry, in their refrigerator, in their medicine chest, in their closet, and then you ask questions about that item. So the questions that we ask are, what are the effects of this item on ourselves as individuals, on other people, on animals, and on the environment? And we ask the positive and the negative effects. And those questions just by themselves could be somebody's dissertation. I mean, if you take out from your, you know, pantry, you know, a Campbell's chicken noodle soup, my goodness, what you're going to discover about the effects on people, on animals, on the environment are really quite extreme and shocking. And the next question would be, what are the systems in place that perpetuate this particular item? So, you know, you take out an article of clothing in your closet, and you maybe look at your closet, and it's filled with more clothes than you will ever wear. And you ask, you know, what is perpetuating this particular item, this non-organic cotton shirt, or this sweatshop-made dress? And then the last question is, there are two more questions. The next question is, what might be an alternative that does more good and less harm? And then finally, if there isn't a good alternative, what systems would need to change to make a good alternative commonplace and accessible? And when I say there may not be an alternative, I mean, I have a cell phone and I have a computer, and I don't have good alternatives for my cell phone and my computer that are really humane and just and sustainable. So what systems would need to change in the mining industry, in the factory, and you know, the production industry to make these kinds of electronics just and peaceful?
Those are wonderful questions, and that activity seems very, very powerful. Have you had people respond to you about ways that they've done that activity and some of the outcomes?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, it's probably the most common humane education activity that I do and that other humane educators do. And so, the real outcomes are, how does it shift your own choices, and how do you become a better systems thinker and start thinking about shifting systems? And we've just designed an entire curricular unit. It's a six-week unit, but it's very adaptable, and it's for high school students, but also adaptable to middle school. And the guiding question of this unit is, what is the connection between the primary causes of death of people in the United States and the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico? And in the process of answering that question, students are becoming systems thinkers. They're doing True Price. And the last 2 weeks of the unit, they then work on coming up with solutions to the thing that connects the primary causes of death in the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which is our agricultural system. So it's really quite a powerful unit, and people will be able to download that free within the month on our website.
So you're producing solutionaries.
Exactly. That's the goal.
And I would assume so that what you mean by that is sort of an individualistic version of what we mean by constructive program, creating alternative. The way Gandhi, for example, had people spin cotton instead of just rejecting the British imports.
So I know less about that term than I mean, solutionary is a made-up term, but it's really just a problem solver. I think that we need to educate a generation of solutionaries. Problem solver sounds, I don't know, it sounds not as visionary or as exciting as a solutionary. And of course, when I hear the word solutionary, I also think of revolutionary. So I like the word. Even though I didn't make it up myself, I love the word and I've been using it. And I think that should be the purpose of education. And I think that if that were the purpose of education, everything else would fall into place.
We're talking with Zoe Weil, co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education. You can see her TED Talks online and read her books and go to their website for a lot of information about this. Learn how to become a humane educator. Zoe, before we go, can you talk a little bit about this idea of the most good? And maybe how it interconnects with some work that you might have done with business leaders, because it says that you have been, you've given interviews on Forbes.com, for example. So that's really interesting. You're not just working with educators, you're working with people who are making business decisions on behalf of consumers.
Well, I will tell you that term, most good, it came from I wrote a book called Most Good, Least Harm, A Simple Principle for a Better World, Meaningful Life. And I call it the MOGO principle, MOGO being short for most good. And it's basically the golden rule taken to the next level. And again, you know, in our complex world, it's very hard to know how to do the most good. And so it takes practice and it takes work. And, you know, I wish I had the opportunity to do more with business leaders. I was interviewed for Forbes.com, and it was a very popular interview, which was so rewarding. I mean, to have, I think it was, you know, it was viewed 5,000 times or something. So that was exciting that, you know, people who are reading Forbes.com would read this interview with me about humane education. But I think what that suggests is that, you know, people who are in business, it's not as if people are waking up saying, you know, how can I harm the environment? How can I make a less sustainable, less just world? There are so many entrenched and seemingly intractable systems that it's very, very difficult to extricate ourselves from. And yet, you know, business leaders have grandchildren and children, and they want a good world for them. And how we're going to get there is complex. It, you know, we have a lot of systems to shift and change, and they're very hard to change. The education system being a behemoth and one of the hardest ones to change. But whether it's our energy system, our agricultural system, our political system, our economic system, there are aspects of all of these systems that are good and have brought prosperity and great things to many people, and many aspects, as we know, that are unjust and cruel and need to shift. And so I hope more business leaders will contact me. And one of the really exciting projects that we're working on right now is we are further developing our Solutionary Congress program, in which middle and high school students address a real-world problem and come up with systemic solutions, not Band-Aids, not just raising money to, you know, put, for a charitable contribution, but really trying to change systems. And these Solutionary Congresses will be gatherings of these student teams and places where they're going to present their solutions. And our goal is to have this become, we're going to pilot it in 2016, in a deep way. We've had a few Solutionary Congresses, but we're deepening this and further developing it, pilot it, work out the kinks, and then have national conferences at which we have political leaders and we have media and we have social entrepreneurs and investors attending to actually invest and make these solutions happen.
Well, so that's very heartwarming. I have been dying to ask you this question. You, me, and Bernie Sanders have something in common. We all come from Brooklyn.
Oh, I come from Manhattan. I have.
Oh.
Sorry, but still New York.
I'm reaching out.
New Yorkers.
We're New Yorkers, right? Good. So,
I have one last question for Zoe before we shift or just end the show, because this has been a great interview and we're so grateful to have you, Zoe, on our show.
Well, it's a pleasure.
So you have an activity called the Council of Beings. And I believe that's what it's called, the Council of Beings. And you invite students to become another being and to speak for that being, beings that might not have a voice. Is that really the gist of the practice?
It is, and it like many of the ways in which I've been a humane educator, I have found these ideas from other people. And The Council of All Beings was actually a book written by Joanna Macy and Arnest and two other people, actually, a short book. And I remember getting this book and thinking, oh, my gosh, I have to do this with young people. And so I began doing the Council of All Beings with young people and then with adults as well. And, yes, they literally, through their imagination, become another being in their mind, and they'll make a mask to represent themselves, and then we'll speak in a council, and I'll talk about what's happening to them and what they want to change, and also what gifts they have to offer as this being. You know, that gets back to the best qualities of human beings. And so in this activity, you know, it sounds, again, a little touchy-feely, a little out there, but I have watched, you know, the most, the kids who you would never ever think would want to do anything like this, become poets, become just one boy in particular. I did this in his high school. He was a senior. He was about to go off to an Ivy League college, super smart. He always played devil's advocate in class. He was just, he never even seemed to have an emotional reaction to some of these issues. And we did the Council of All Beings, and I was so worried that he was just going to find the whole thing ridiculous. And in fact, he became the ocean. This poetry came out of his mouth. He was just, it was so stunning to me. I think my jaw dropped. And at the end of the whole thing, it was the last day of our class, and we were saying our goodbyes, and I thanked them for taking the course because it was an after-school course. And he said, no, Zoe, thank you, because when I look back on high school, this is what I'm going to remember.
Okay, so here's my challenge for you today. as we end our show, would you be willing to embody some being today that might be on your heart and mind to help to bring their voice to the radio? Is that something you might be willing to do?
Well, you know, the reason why I would be hesitant to do it is because in the process of becoming that being, it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd have a lot of silence on the radio while I meditated on that being and really brought it forth in my mind. And sometimes what will happen when I lead a council is I'll invite people, they close their eyes, and they may have lots of beings come to them, right? There might be the megafauna they first think of, you know, some, you know, lion or some polar bear. And then suddenly what will appear will be the tiniest little being, or it will be a shrub, or it will be a cactus. And so I have to give people plenty of time and to find out what being is sort of speaking to them today. And so if I did it right now, I think I would be forcing it, and it wouldn't be real, and I wouldn't want to do that.
I'm glad that you spoke from your heart with that. Thank you.
Yeah, and we might lose our place on this station if we. Zoe, a quick story that I think you'll appreciate. There was a very, very, quote, tough school. I think it was in Boston. It was so tough that when a new administrator, new principal came in, he was told, you're crazy. This will be the end of your career. They'd been through so many principals. Well, the first thing that this young person did was he fired the entire security staff.
Huh.
And then with the money that he saved, he restarted the art program.
Mm.
And that school has now become one of the safest and happiest schools in the district.
Yeah. Beautiful. What a beautiful way to end our hour.
Yes. So we've so much enjoyed talking with you. We've been talking with Zoe Weil, the co-founder and president of the Institute for Humane Education. What's the website, Zoe?
It's humaneeducation.org.
Humaneeducation.org. Thank you so much for joining us on Peace Paradigm Radio.
Well, thank you so much. And I have really enjoyed talking to you, and keep up your wonderful work.
Thank you. So we usually do a segment on nonviolence in the news. And with 2 minutes left that we are supposed to be in the studio, that doesn't look like that will be possible today on this show in particular. But what we're going to do is we're going to record the nonviolence in the news directly after the show, and we will put it up on MediCenter's website. That's MediCenter.org, Meta with 2 T's, that you can listen both to the interview with Zoe Weil and with the nonviolence in the news with Michael Negler. So thank you, everybody, for joining us today about education and humane education. And until the next time, take care of one another. Bye-bye.